nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Well, thank you very much for showing up in great numbers. My name is Gerhard Klimek. I'm the technical director of the Network for Computational Nanotechnology. And I guess I'm reviewing in this presentation about 6 to 8 years of research. So one of my colleagues asked me to tell you to buckle down, take the seatbelt, lean back, right? It's going to go rather rapidly. I like to motivate, just like you've seen many talks, this work with Moore's Law. And I pulled this off of Intel's website, and everybody knows what that is. And this is sort of just a fly-through to set the stage that this is really enabled by device miniaturization. And to give you an example, these are all also pulled off of the Intel website. This is their a cross-section of their 19-nanometer node. So there's critical dimensions that are of 1.2 nanometers in their 90-nanometer node. Then this is a picture of their 60-nanometer node. And actually, if you've been to the dentist lately, you might have identified these as x-rays of your teeth or something, right? There is 3D topology. These things are not smooth. It's certainly not bulk. If you look at the 45-nanometer node, they talk about a 1-nanometer high-K dielectric. And actually, these are images where you can identify a crystalline structure of the device underneath. Certainly not bulk either. If you look at the 30-nanometer node, it's getting into 3D. So not just stacked devices anymore, but things running across each other and 3D geometries. And then they do something interesting for their outlook. They quote a paper by Charles Lieber from 1998 where they have nanowires. So that's not their own work, but these are all images taken from the Intel website. And the point is that really the material variations are happening in 3D on the nanometer scale. Okay, that's the take-home message of this introduction. And that is why it's important to think about how do you model such devices. And just to give you, for the graduate students that are sitting here, nanotechnology as such has not always been a buzzword, but it's been around for quite a while. People have been doing nanoelectronic research for quite a while, way before the year 2000 when the nano initiative was announced by President Clinton. So here's this image by Charles Lieber of 98, and there's other images where I've been involved at JPL where we started to model quantum dots. And that's where I want to start out with and give you an outline of what can Nemo3D as a modeling tool do in this realm of devices where there's 3D spatial variations and there is electronic structure that needs to be computed on that level. All right. So how can you put it all in one simulator? And this is sort of the nano electronic modeling agenda, this NEMO agenda, to start out from the top left in atomic orbitals that are roughly of size 0.2 nanometers, put them into realistic geometries, tie these atoms together into crystals like quantum dots or carbon nanotubes, and in these structures compute nanometer scale quantum states that are, for example, artificial atoms. So that would be the quantum dots. And from those properties, extract measurable quantities that are relevant to sensors or computing devices. But the essence is to go from atomic descriptions to measurable quantities that are relevant to devices. Now, if you want to do such a thing, you will have to do quantum mechanics, and you will have to consider the atoms by themselves. And the key is really, or the claim that I want to show you in this presentation is, that you cannot use bulk or gallium descriptions anymore. It matters what the crystalline topology is in that material, and it matters how the interfaces look. It matters how the material is composed. So if you want to do it in an atomistic way, it comes down to a choice of basis states. How do you do quantum mechanics? Most material scientists and physicists do this with plane waves. They say, we're going to do our quantum mechanics in plane waves, and they call it pseudopotentials. And really what they do is they describe the Schrödinger wave equation with plane waves and use that as a basis. Plane waves, from my perspective, are great for infinite materials, huge chunks of materials. But as I've just shown you, we're not going towards huge chunks of materials. We're going towards small chunks of materials, of dissimilar materials that are next to each other. So from my perspective, I'd rather use a basis that is local, that is not of infinite extent. And the choice that we do is we use empirical tight binding. So we have a description of the electronic structure of an atom in s, p, and d orbitals. And we want to do that in such a way that we don't just write a code for a particular problem, but write a general code that is useful for many different problems. So we want to really have a design tool. So that was started around 1998. We worked very hard on finding the right tight binding parameters, develop methodologies that are based on genetic algorithm fitting towards bulk material properties. That's not the topic of this presentation. You can learn about more of band structure in other presentations. But here I really want to just highlight results that you can get with such a 3D tool. So the point is we need a realistic material description at the atomic level that enables simulation of realistically large devices. And that means it might be millions of atoms in there. Okay? So how do you get to millions of atoms? Well, you do it in parallel computing. And here is a demonstration of the capability. On the lower left, you see a time versus number of millions of atoms in a simulation running on a TeraGrid machine. And we were able to show up to 21 million atoms in the electronic structure calculation. That is roughly 78 by 78 by 78 nanometers. That's a significant volume of real estate that you can represent devices in. Then the next question is, what do you do if you actually had 21 million atom results? How do you visualize it? There were efforts in a tool building that is now called VolQD, where we can visualize orbitals in these artificial atoms and decompose them in their S and P and D contributions and actually gain insight. And some of the insight is that the contributions may be orthogonal. So the S orbital contribution might be completely orthogonal to P and D orbital contributions. And right now there's efforts underway to demonstrate that that orthogonality actually has big impact on silicon devices that are in small channels or in nanowires. The next, once we had that capability, this is really the baseline of the NanoHub Viz server that we're serving on the NanoHub. All right, so here's the presentation outline. I tried to introduce a little bit about nanoelectronics, why it's relevant. And now I'm just going to fly over some band structure basics, and then we'll study alloy disorder in quantum dots. And we'll talk about alloy disorder in nanowires, and then in bulk. And then at the end, I'll conclude. So band structure basics. So quantum mechanics was really, in a sense, discovered by the analysis of optical spectra that are coming out of atoms. That's how people realized that there's discrete orbitals, and you need to describe it with a quantum mechanical setting. Now, the question is, what if you take these isolated atoms that are described by S and P orbitals, and you bring them together into a solid? What happens there is these formerly disjoint orbitals start to talk to each other. They are coupled to each other. And electrons can move in these bands, quote-unquote, freely, and you come to this theory of solids and where you can have transport and conductivity and mobility. So that is, in these bands, you can do have electrons move freely, and you come from the world of physics to real devices. Now, the thing that is really exciting in nanoelectronics is that you can start to compose systems of different atoms. So let's imagine we have blue atoms and yellow atoms, and maybe we just look at one band for now, just to set the stage. And these bands might be misaligned because they're different materials. So if we bring them together, we can stack them on top of each other, maybe a chain of blue, yellow, blue, yellow. And then you would expect that there's misalignments between these bands. And then what people do is they kind of forget about these atomic potentials that are sitting underneath. They just draw basically square boxes, and then they kind of forget that these square boxes were originally defined by atomic planes. They just draw these band diagrams, and then they do quantum mechanics on these square band diagrams, and they compute eigenstates and wave functions. And then they even kind of forget about the wave function details and just draw these straight lines that indicate the levels. Levels in quantum system, like a quantum well, and devices that are relevant, for example, to photon absorption, photon emission, and to transport, for example, tunneling through barriers. These are all quantum mechanical capabilities in these nanoscale devices that have a great capability to them. For example, if you have mechanisms for photon absorption, you can build detectors, right? You can absorb a photon and kick out an electron and measure that that electron shows up. That's a detector of light. If you have a way to control the emission of photons through electrons, you have a laser. And if you have a way to control tunneling, you might be able to have logic and memory devices, for example, in resonant tunneling diodes. So overall, these quantum mechanical capabilities give you a lot of design room to play with. Now, let's go back to what this picture that we had here in 1D, where we're just aligning atoms. The question now is, what happens in 3D? So in 3D, there's technology where we can grow indium arsenide, for example, on top of gallium arsenide, and this indium arsenide likes to clump up. It likes to clump up in perfect crystalline structures that are called quantum dots. So, and then we can grow gallium arsenide over them again. And we basically have an indium arsenide being confined by gallium arsenide. And that is sort of like having the yellow atoms here with a lower band edge surrounded by the blue atoms. If you do that in 3D, you can compute a ground state, for example, in this dome-shaped three-dimensional quantum dots. So that's, people do that in various methods. And now the question is, what if you didn't have a nicely ordered system where it's indium arsenide, and in this diagram, this indium on the middle graph is represented by blue dots, and yellow is gallium. What if you have a structure that is actually an alloy? What if there's indium 40%, gallium 60% arsenide? Experimentally, there will be no way to order that alloy. Okay, so for every indium or gallium site, there will be sort of a randomness associated with it. That means one sample to the next is going to look dramatically different from the other. Okay, so here's underneath you see animations of 20 instances of quantum dots. So these are just 20 samples that might exist. And it looks reasonably random, and it is random. Okay, and the question now is, what happens in the electronic structure of these dots? Is this of any relevance? Can we see effects of that? All right, so here's the same animation now on a larger scale, so you can see a little bit easier. So in a sense, what we have here is statistical properties. One quantum dot will look different from another. So we have to do statistical methods to analyze the devices. What do people typically do when they have an alloy system? They say, well, that's kind of hard to do to really figure out an atomistic description. And actually, what's really, really hard for the people that use plane waves, they would have to increase the number of plane waves that are participating in the material description that is proportional to the degree of freedom that is inside the system. So if I have a lot of fluctuations there, you need to put in a lot of plane waves to resolve that. Whereas here, in this tight binding method, the degrees of freedom don't increase. They're fixed by the number of atoms that we have. So what typically people do is they say, well, we really don't know how to do this in an average. And you see basically in sort of an average atom that's a kind of a new indium gallium atom that is sort of composed of some properties of indium and some properties of gallium. But basically, the whole thing is smoothed out. So in the next slide, or in the next part, that I want you to focus on, so what happens at the interface. So again, you see an animation there, and you really, in a sense, see that interface move. There is no predefined interface. I mean, there's this yellow is penetrating into the dot and out of the dot. It's not a sharp interface. So if you were to smooth all of this, like most people do, you have a sharp interface again. It is, you can expect that there should be differences from one treatment and the other. All right, so VCI really ignores all of that, and we want to examine what are the consequences of that. So here's the question now. People were building these indium gallium arsenide dots, and they couldn't quite control the size of these dots. So there will be fluctuations in there. But let's make this Gedanken experiment where in an ideal world, you maybe can control exactly the size and the shape of the dots. What they wouldn't control is the disorder in the dot. And then the question is, what would you see experimentally in line width, of optical line width? What are the fluctuations of the optical line width that you would measure? And Rosa Leon at JPL at the time measured around 30 millielectron volt of fluctuations. So the question now is, how much of that is size variations and internal fluctuations? One thing to appreciate about indium arsenide, indium gallium arsenide, is it's an alloy. And normally we think of an alloy as an average thing where atoms are averaged over and distances between atoms are averaged over. But what you see on the bottom right is a curve that is in black experimental data. And what was measured was a distribution of bond lengths. So I believe that is a sort of an X-ray experiment. I forgot the details. But basically they measure that on the X-axis they have the indium concentration, and on the Y-axis they have the bond lengths they measure. And you see a bimodal distribution. Basically, indium arsenide bonds like to be indium arsenide, and gallium arsenide-like bonds like to be gallium arsenide-like, meaning the indium is going to push the arsenic away, and the gallium locally gladly pulls it closer. It is not just a straight average, as indicated through the diagonal middle line. Okay, so there should be some evidence in the electronic structure of that. So now let's take a look at the electronic structure of such an embedded quantum dot. I have a quantum dot embedded in gallium arsenide, and I'm going to march along the plane through the middle of the dot. So if it were a homogeneous dot, we would expect on the top left a conduction band edge that basically provides confinement for electrons, and a valence band that due to strain is going to be split into two bands, a heavy hole and a light hole band. So that's the expectation if the material were smooth. Now, if the material is not smooth and you have an atomic resolution of this material, you can think about expecting that there should be gallium arsenide-like bonds and indium arsenide-like bonds. And what we'll do is we'll march through this dot now, and for every arsenic atom, we'll look at the four neighbors and figure out what is the distance, and imagine that that small cell is repeated infinitely, and we figure out what is the band edge diagram for that particular neighbor, or for that particular arsenic atom. And what we'll find is that there's two types of electronic bonds represented in this dot. So in the bottom, on the top left, you see red dots. They indicate the raised indium arsenide energies due to compressive strain. And on the top, you see the blue dots. Those are gallium arsenide-like bonds that have been stretched. So really, the bottom of your conduction band is no longer smooth, and there's populations of indium arsenide and gallium arsenide-like bonds. Now, for the holes, things are more complicated because you have heavy hole, light hole, indium arsenide, and gallium arsenide-like combinations. So there should be four sets. And indeed, you find four sets, which makes this rather messy. Okay, so again, what you thought might be the bottom of the top of a valence band in the quantum dot may not be all that much of a smooth function anymore. So now the question is, does it matter? So let's look at a state, first with a quantum dot again, just to set the stage where everything is smooth in this VCA approach. And we compute, say in 3D, a ground state like that. And here are two other representations. Basically, a 3D representation of the wave function, the scatter plot on the top left, and the bottom left, a 2D slice through it. And you see perfect spherical symmetry, right? Everything looks very nice, very smooth. The simulator does work, okay? Now, if you introduce disorder in the system, your formerly S-like ground state wave function looks rather ragged. It's not smooth. It has local variations. And you can measure the eigenenergy of this system. And let's calibrate this guy in the middle to zero. Let's just call it zero. If we have another instance, just another sample, we calculate a wave function that's dramatically different. And it looks different, and its eigenenergy is different. And it varies from the middle guy by some 3 mV. So you might say, that's interesting, Klimek, but does that have any statistical significance? Right? I mean, so you pick two. You probably pick the two worst ones you can find. Not quite. So how about running 560 different quantum dots and looking at the energy distribution of these quantum dots? So let's do that for the valence band. We find a sigma of roughly 1 mV. And let's do that for the conduction band. We roughly find 1.4 mV. And then let's look at the gap. We find roughly 2.3 mV. Note that the gap indeed, in this case, is roughly the summation of the two fluctuations. So the fluctuations in the gap come together with the fluctuations in the individual bands. That suggests that there is some correlation between these, and indeed there is. Basically, if the valence band goes up, the conduction band comes down. If the valence band goes down, the conduction band goes up. That's basically the data falling along that statistical line there. All right, so they are correlated. And what we've done here is really a purely atomistic disorder. So for every indium or gallium site, we throw a dice. It was weighted by 40% indium, 60% gallium, and just roll the dice for 560 different quantum dots. That means, well, sorry, let me back out. So what happens if there's some sort of clustering in the device? What happens if the indium arsenide would like to stay closer to indium arsenide, and that there are zones which like to be more like gallium arsenide? The easy way to do that in NEMO 3D, which may not be the most physical way, is to say, instead of rolling the dice for each indium or gallium atom, we can roll the dice for each unit cell. A unit cell consists of 8 atoms, 4 arsenics, and then 4 either indiums or galliums, and we roll the dice there. So effectively, we have clustering within a unit cell. So if we do that, you get statistical variations like this. So we ran now 490 clustered indium arsenide quantum dots, and what we find is that the valence band moves up, the conduction band roughly stays the same, the gap becomes smaller, and overall the statistical variations broaden. So there's more fluctuations due to chunking up or clustering up inside the system. So it increases the noise, it shifts the valence band, decreases the band gap. So noise seems to matter in these systems. So why does the noise increase? You can ask again the question, is there a correlation? So you've seen the bottom left curve in the dark blue, the same correlation exists for the clustered eigenenergies. So is it maybe indium concentrations? Maybe the indium itself is now varying so broadly that there should be fluctuations. Not really. The indium concentration has a statistical significance of 0.0016, whereas it's intended to be at 0.6. So it's not the indium that is broadly varying. Really, it's the that's the other thing. You can try to correlate the conduction band edge versus the indium concentration. And basically, you see a round ball, right? So it doesn't have a lot of... Yes? Oh, questions. So we got to defer questions for later. Sorry. So they are weakly correlated. All right. So the way I look at this is it is in the crystal distortions and the larger wave function distortions, which give you delta E's. And so it's really... the wave functions really being deformed by the confining material, by being rather randomized. All right. So the answer is, if you include statistical variations in identical dots, the fluctuations will be somewhere between 1 and 5 mV, which is a sizable chunk of the experimental 30, which includes size variations and shape variations and distance variations between dots. So it is... even if you controlled now size and shape, you'll have noise of that order of 5 mV or so. All right. So now let's look at nanowires. Let's look at transmissions and approximate band structures of nanowires. So here is an experimental graph of a nanowire. It's a 112 nanowire. Let's look at a slightly different structure just for argument's sake, because this is quote-unquote a perfect nanowire. So we take a 2 nanometer 001 wire that is infinitely long, and it's really part of a separate discussion on how you would compute a dispersion in that wire. But if you can compute such a dispersion, and you can do these things on the nanohub now, what you would get is bands that are rather not parabolic in structures like this. And for every band, you basically get a turn-on in the transmission coefficient. Every band provides you a channel through the device that's on the bottom right. To see that more easily, let me turn that transmission axis around and make sure that the energy axes are aligned, and then I can draw sort of dashed lines indicating to you that for every turn-on of a band, I have a step function in the transmission. Okay? And the key message is that that relationship is true if the system is ordered. If the system is disordered, that clean-cut relationship goes away. So let's look at a disordered nanowire. So if we had a perfect nanowire and we're going to insert, say, aluminum atoms into a gallium arsenide wire, what we'll have is, again, random placement of aluminum on gallium sites. Certainly, that structure is not periodic, and similar to the quantum dots, we would expect that there is effects of disorder. So again, how do people mostly do that? They say, well, let me do a VCA. VCA means I'm going to average these yellow and blue atoms out to some green atoms, and I'm going to end up with a smooth structure. Okay? There is no spatial variations. If you have no spatial variations, then your EK diagrams and transmissions are going to align again. Right? So this is a similar graph now calculated for this AlGaAs wire, where the band structure and the transmission agree, can be aligned nicely, and for every band you're going to pick up a transmission coefficient. Now, the question is, what happens if you do introduce these randomly placed aluminum atoms? First of all, we have a method to compute an approximate band structure that I'll be talking later in this presentation about, and we can compute the transmission coefficients through these devices. And you notice on the right that the transmission is no longer nice step functions. It rather looks fluctuating. And you might ask yourself, why is that? For example, there's some peaks that you identify that are aligned with the bottom of the conduction band roughly. But what are these? And why isn't it not a smooth function? So what we can do is we can take this disordered nanowire and imagine we walk through it slice by slice and figure out what would be the conduction band edge and each slice. And you find that the conduction band edge fluctuates from slice to slice by this graph indicated on the middle left. Then we can superimpose what we call a density of states in this wire. And you find that there is localized states in this disordered wire. So it's not just a homogeneous density of states that exists that gives you a nice transmission coefficient. It's actually, in a sense, like a resonant tunneling diode that has a resonance state, and in fact, the local density of states peak aligns very nicely with the transmission peak at the very same energy. So as you make structures very small in one dimension and you put in disorder, you will get localization in the structure. This is not something completely unknown to the field of mesoscopic devices, but certainly not appreciated in the world of nanoelectronic devices from the silicon or silicon germanium side. All right, so we did this for aluminum gallium arsenide because we didn't have to consider strain and things like that. The next thing to do is do this for a silicon germanium wire and see what the transmission and the transport would look like when the devices become small. All right, so just to set the stage before we do bulk calculation, to remind you, in alloy wires, we have fluctuations in the transmission and the band edges. For quantum dots, we have fluctuations in the wave functions and the eigenenergies. Now the question is, what happens in bulk? Can you learn something in bulk when you have disorders? Are there fluctuations? What does bulk really mean? How large is large enough? When do we have bulk? What constitutes bulk, a bulk property? And if there's no repeated cell, like in this aluminum gallium arsenide, what does band structure really mean, right? We are used to doing it for a small cell. So let's try to answer some of these questions. And it gets us to the last third of the presentation, where we'll talk about a supercell calculation. We'll talk about approximate band structure and consider three different disorder types in bulk. All right. So typically when we do a band structure calculation, what we do is we define a one-atom pair like that. For example, gallium arsenide, and we put it into a single-unit cell. And we imagine through periodic boundary conditions that that gets mapped into some infinite crystal. But all the calculations are really done on that one pair. And you're representing that one pair with a relatively small matrix, and you assume that there's no fluctuations whatsoever in this material. And what you get is dispersions like this one, like gallium arsenide, or like indium arsenide that you can overlay like this. But these are material properties computed on two atoms. And these two atoms are assumed to be infinitely periodically repeated in that unit cell. There is no such thing as a fluctuation. Okay? You know that pair, you know how they're oriented, you know how the rest of your world looks. Now the question is, in an alloy, we know in indium gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide, or silicon germanium, we do have band gaps. We do know, we can measure experimentally effective masses. We know band structure exists. It's a fact, right? At least in a certain sense. But from a fundamentally theoretical point of view, band structure shouldn't exist because you don't have a repeated cell that gives you dispersions just like this one on the left, because these cells don't even match. So what does this mean? So what you can do is, what most people again do, they do this virtual crystal approximation, and they try to capture some things of this disorder. And the question now is, does this disorder matter? So one way is to do a supercell calculation. And what that really means is you take a cell that is maybe large enough, and you repeat it infinitely periodically. Okay, and you hope to capture the central cell to make that big enough to capture the important physics. The question now is, how big is big enough? But before you do that, there's a problem that you have to resolve if you're really interested in band structure. So let's assume we have some material that has a dispersion that looks like this, and we compute it on a tiny cell, like in the lower left. If I double the unit cell size, I fold my EK diagram over once. I get that green curve. If I make the cell twice as large again, I fold over again. If I make it bigger still, I fold over more and more. And eventually, what I get is eigenvalues that are sitting on my k equals zero axis. So if you don't do anything, the only thing you can really find is the bottom of the conduction band, right? On the bottom, just above the one here, you can find the bottom of a conduction band edge and maybe the top of a valence band. But you will not resolve an EK diagram. In fact, the EK diagram you compute is only valid for the supercell in a supercell momentum space. So you get a really messy diagram of really folded over states, and chances are your system has now become so large you can't even compute all the eigenstates in the system. I mean, just remember, if you add more atoms to the system, you add more eigenstates and eigenvalues to the system. If you have huge eigenvalues, you can't afford to compute all of them. And chances are you won't converge on all of them. So you can only probably afford to compute the ones that are at the supercell zero. And then chances are you can't even get all of them. You have to live that you won't catch all of them because they're densely packed. So that's a numerical problem. Either way, we were able to tackle these issues, to compute and basically unfold that messy dispersion on the left back to a dispersion on the right that we know and love. We can do it exactly for systems that have no distortions. But you might say, who cares? If there's no distortions, why would you even bother? Well, we can now insert distortions and also compute approximate band structures, where there's fluctuations in the band structure, and we can measure these fluctuations. So that's a key element of this, of these calculations. So now let me show you a couple of examples. So here is a random aluminum gallium arsenide cell that's computed with 1,200 atoms, and the solid line is a virtual crystal approximation, and the dots with error bars are the random alloy calculation. And the most striking thing is that the band gap at gamma is smaller, and you have a real disordered alloy. So let me highlight some of that in the next slides. But the first one here now is we can also, extract an effective mass from the gamma point, for example. And we can plot that effective mass now as a function of aluminum concentration, and we can match that to experimental data nicely. Now let's visit this issue of the band gap one more time. What I'm plotting here is experimental data of the X valley and the gamma valley as a function of aluminum concentration for the conduction band. And you might know that roughly at 45%, there's a crossover between a direct gap and an indirect gap material. So aluminum gallium arsenide is first direct, and if you increase the aluminum content further, it turns into an indirect gap, and that's this crossover. Now, if you do what most people do, which is called virtual crystal approximation, let me back out. So our calculation gets, with random alloy, we basically match the experiment very nicely. And if we do a virtual crystal approximation, we don't match very nicely. In fact, for small aluminum values, the band gap is rather different. In fact, the virtual crystal approximation gives you too high of a conduction band. So now let's plot the band gap for the experiment, the random alloy, and the VCA as a function of aluminum concentration. And the red line on top shows the deviation, effectively, of a couple of hundred millielectron volt versus experiment. Now we can ask, do these fluctuations on that blue curve, the black curve, the random alloy, do they matter? And how large are they? How are they distributed? What system is large enough? When do you see bulk? Those are the fundamental questions we want to answer. And so let's do that. Let's take a sample of 3,000 atoms. We take 2,800 samples, and we compute the conduction band edge for these 2,800 samples. Okay, and we find a deviation of roughly 0.5 millielectron volt. Let's do the same thing for the valence band edge, and there's something somewhat funny that it's sort of a distorted distribution. And we can compute the gap as well. So if we do that on these samples, what you see here is that the standard deviations don't add quite up. The gap is not completely, gap variations are not made up of conduction and valence band gap, valence band fluctuations. So let's plot again the statistical variations, or for every sample, the valence band edge energy and the conduction band edge energy. And what you see is basically a round ball. These are uncorrelated. You can't lay a correlation through there. And this example is slightly different what I have shown previously in the quantum dots. What is different here is what we've done is in these samples exactly fixed the aluminum concentration. In this case, it's 20% aluminum out of 3,000 atoms, which is 1,500 anions and 1,500 cations. So it's exactly 300 aluminum atoms. We only considered where there's exactly 300 aluminum atoms in this chunk. Okay, so in other words, the concentration itself is a delta function at 0.2. That's rather unrealistic, right? If you numerically, what you can do is you can throw dice, and if you just throw dice on a system of 3,000 atoms, you get a distribution of aluminum concentration in there. It's not a delta function. That distribution is 0.011, And you get an amazingly strong effect on the fluctuations on the conduction band edge and the valence band edge. So the blue lines are the curves from the top, and the red is now including aluminum concentration fluctuations. So in other words, it's very important to also consider fluctuations in the aluminum in the system. And if you now plot the valence band edges and the conduction band edges against each other, you'll find that they're correlated. Again, like what we had in the quantum dots in the same experiment, if the conduction band goes down, the valence band goes up, and vice versa. All right? Now there's an interesting caveat, and since we're about talking about bulk and how large of a system do you have to have, if your system is small, like 140 atoms, you'll find that not every aluminum concentration is allowed. Right? It's actually discrete enough, meaning there's discrete allowed aluminum concentrations that are available in the system, and you can't hit it in between because the numbers of atoms are countable. So you're discretizing your system. And if you do that and run a small system calculation like that and you gather statistical samples of conduction bands and valence bands, you'll find that they're dominated in the noise pattern by the aluminum concentration discrete. All right, so you've seen the correlations of the topmost graph and the middle graphs. Interestingly, if you do the correlations now in the tiny system, in the 140 atom system, you'll find that indeed you have correlation on the larger scale, and then inside you have no correlation of the delta functions of concentration. So the pictures correlate nicely to each other. All right, now the next thing to ask is, can you tell us more about these fluctuations and how do they vary? So I showed you previously 20%, right? You can argue if there's no aluminum, there shouldn't be noise. And if the aluminum concentration is roughly 50%, you expect the largest noise because it gives you the largest fluctuations you can find in this configuration space. And for the valence band, that's true. Basically, in the blue line, I'm showing the configuration noise, no aluminum fluctuations at 1,000 atoms. And the conduction band noise actually shows an interesting feature at the transition point of gamma to X. There's actually a spike in that distribution. Now the question is, if you allow also for concentration noise, so where the aluminum atoms can fluctuate the concentration, you find, just again, a much larger contribution in the noise when you have configuration and concentration noise, and you find a tremendously large feature, again, in the conduction band edge. And in a sense, you can argue that there is a transition between gamma and X. And at the X point, the masses are much, much heavier. So fluctuations may not be as dramatic as in the lighter gamma point. So eigenenergies will not fluctuate as dramatically. So that was talking about a 1,000-atom system. I haven't really answered the question, how large is large enough? So let's look at that. So what I'm plotting here is the conduction band, the valence band. Valence band on the left, conduction band on the right, as a function of number of atoms. And notice that these graphs are non-monotonic. Okay? It's not like, well, you just add more atoms and I'm going to monotonically go to a certain direction. This is for, and the noise becomes smaller as you make the system size larger. And it follows roughly a one over square root n law of large numbers, just like what you expect. Now, if you also look at, again, concentration noise, and we know that's larger, you see that the deviations are getting smaller with system size, and they're pretty large if you have 100 atoms. It's as large as a 100, roughly, millielectron volt. Now, there's a third kind of noise that I had alluded to. What if you have cluster disorder, which should increase the disorder further? And it indeed does. These are on these green lines. And what you find is it's roughly an order of magnitude larger than the concentration noise already. And again, the take-home message here is it's hard to see on the projector, that the noise becomes quite large if you only have around 100 atoms. So I want to take that graph as sort of that take-home message graph, that if you're interested in electronic structure calculations of bulk that have disorder in them, you can expect that the properties you compute are behaving non-monotonically as you make the system size larger. Okay, these curves are going down and back up. So please take note, from my perspective, bulk starts maybe at 100,000 atoms, at least in these calculations. And 100,000 atoms is roughly 12 nanometer in each direction, 12 nanometer by 12 nanometer by 12 nanometer. And please also note, if you look at the literature on people that do ab initio calculations, they typically work in 100 atoms or less. Okay? So if they are looking at properties that, of structures that have disorder in them, you have to take this with a grain of salt. They're not really exploring all the configuration space of these structures because they're limited by computing. Okay? So that's the take-home message of this slide. I summarized a whole bunch of work, really 6 to 8 years of research that was going on at JPL and here at Purdue on the NEMO 3D. These are the references you can look up with respect to these various topics. And I just want to summarize now that I try to explain to you and give you some physical insight that there is tremendous fluctuations in wave functions in quantum dots if you allow for fluctuations in the material properties. There is fluctuations in transmissions and band edges in nanowires that are going to be visible on quantum transport and affect the device behavior. And bulk alloys can be computed if you make your supercell large enough. And for me, large supercells start at 100,000 atoms if you want to describe bulk. So at this stage, I will just say materials and devices do meet at the atomic scale. That's the key message to take away from this presentation. And we are able to calculate material and device properties that are relevant to real devices. We're not just doing tiny systems now, but we're analyzing structures that are relevant. And since this is on the NanoHub, I'd like to advertise that a little bit. We have methods in place where you can become an uploader and be part of the online simulation, the courses, the tutorials, the seminars, and be part of our users and our community. And with that, I'd like to conclude. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hey, you.
So I'm not terribly familiar with some of the interpretations in these EK diagrams, but my question pertains to this. So in the case where you were talking about in silicon, and you keep increasing, say you double the size of the unit cell, and you see that this EK diagram folds and things sort of get piled up here at low momentum in the supercell. For if there's no disorder, this is basically... it's not real, right? The unit cell is still like, say, the diamond
right.
Lattice, right? Now, if you throw, say, one atom in there, so one sort of defect or impurity.
An oddball.
Per, you know, I don't know, 10 or 1,000 atoms, that sets the size that supercell basically has to be, right?
Right.
So.
Well, actually, you might argue it has to be many times larger because you want to, or have different samples, right? There could be one or two in there as well. And where they are placed and where they're placed with respect to an interface and all that.
So in that case, then, this folding somehow, my question is this, when is this folding real? In the case where there's no actual impurity, that folding is really just an artifact of what you've chosen to be your supercell. When you actually have an impurity in there, somehow this should manifest itself as a difference in what we, you know, measure in terms of transport. And particularly what I'm interested in is direct versus indirect band gaps that we measure. Mm-hmm. So under what cases might one expect to be able to take an indirect band gap, say silicon, and turn it to a direct band gap by
folding
some type of nanostructure?
Okay. I mean, there's, in a sense, there's maybe two questions that I heard, or I'm interpreting them wrong. One is, say you take a nanowire, make it out of silicon, and you have band folding. That's certainly real. And there may be strong optical matrix elements that turn silicon into a Dirac gap material. That's one. So that folding is real because that's the true unit cell. No disorder except it's finite, right? And the dispersion changes. Then the second one is more of an approximate nature where you say, well, when does it start to be real? When you have a little bit of disorder, and when is it a mathematical concept and when is it real? So that one I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure I understand the question. Did I answer the second part?
Yeah, the first part, I think, is a good answer to part of the question. And has that been observed experimentally? Do people see the transition from indirect to direct?
Yeah, I think so, right? There is light emission out of silicon, and I think it's at the frequency or at the optical frequency where it corresponds to being direct gap, I think.
Any other questions? So I have one. No, sorry. Can these properties, transitioning to bulk alloys, have you also looked at the material properties of these types of systems?
What do you mean by tensile properties, etc.?
Yeah, exactly.
No,
they have that.
I have not done that. I strictly look at electronic structure properties. What are the band gaps? What are the transport properties? So, no.
Do you expect that they should have some of these type of properties?
Well, I can see evidence of it in the sense that there is indium arsenide and gallium arsenide-like bonds, right? They like to be in pairs that are different from each other, right? So you would expect that there's mechanical properties that are derived out of that. I mean, normally in a crystal, you might argue it likes to shear, or you can cleave it easily in one direction, right? Because all the bonds are lined up and the planes are lined up. But if there's a bunch of guys sticking out and creating disorder, that should modify that property. But that's, an electronic structure type person talking about mechanical properties. So take that with a grain of salt, right? But I would think that it should matter.
I have a question. Most of the fluctuations earlier in the talk you showed was the band gap was a few millielectron volts. So I'm wondering how important is that, especially at room temperature, and how does this translate to modern devices where you have a few dopants, discrete number of dopants in channels, and how do they make the band gap vary, and how does it show up?
Okay.
Because a lot of people are doing really, really looking into mobilities, and if the band gap changes significantly, then maybe there is somewhere else that we should concentrate.
Yeah. So notice that the fluctuations get larger and larger as you make the system smaller and smaller, right? So if your cross-section only has 10 or 20 atoms in it, you would expect that there is a significant impact of these fluctuations. That's what the nanowires show right here. I mean, that there is no longer a smooth transition or transmission coefficient, right? We're used to, when you do quantum transport in the way we typically do it, that there is smooth steps. Every band gives you a step, boom, right? Clean-cut story. But what this means is that there is localization in the device. It means here. And it means there is fluctuations that are going to be important, even at room temperature. Even if you were to integrate this rather messy curve, you should see some fluctuations in there. Right? I mean, there's people that try to do, well, at room temperature. Never mind. Okay. I think that's...
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.
Mm-hmm.